An agreement between the State Attorney General's Office and Federal Justice Department raises more questions about a lawsuit filed by the Missoula County Attorney. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you how many workers a new Cabela store in Missoula wants to hire. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack about our aging farmers, new funding to fight wildfires, and the challenge of climate change. A Missoula County Commissioner believes the County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg may be throwing the commission, quote, under the bus in the county's lawsuit against the Federal Department of Justice. The DOJ has been investigating how Missoula law enforcement, the University of Montana, and the county attorney's office handle sexual assault cases after a string of such crimes were brought to light in 2012. Both UM and Missoula police have reached settlement agreements with the Department of Justice, but County Attorney Van Valkenburg has refused, saying DOJ has no authority over his office. Van Valkenburg says his office is under the jurisdiction of the State Attorney General. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says an earlier agreement between DOJ and the Attorney General may call that into question.
A 2012 letter from then-Attorney General Steve Bullock to the Department of Justice arranges a meeting with DOJ for a status update on the progress of their investigation into how sexual assault cases are handled in Missoula. Allie Bovingdon is now Governor Steve Bullock's Deputy Chief of Staff, but she worked in the Attorney General's office then, and she was on the conference call with DOJ shortly after that letter was sent out.
The conversation about process was, if during the course of their investigation they uncovered cases, how that referral would occur back to the State Attorney General's office.
That conference call and the communication between the Attorney General and DOJ has Missoula County Commissioner Michelle Landquist second-guessing the merits of County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg's case against DOJ.
I look at that agreement between the AG and the DOJ as the AG giving permission to the DOJ and to do their investigation, and they should have asked Fred to cooperate.
The county commission voted to approve $50,000 for the county to move forward with the lawsuit. She says she's keeping her fingers crossed Attorney Van Valkenburg did not know about any deal between the DOJ and the Attorney General when he requested that funding.
I would have had totally different conversations with Mr. Van Valkenburg had I known that, and I would have never approved the money, and I would have applied a whole lot more pressure than we did.
But Allie Bovingdon, again, she was at the AG's office at the time of the conference call. She says Attorney Van Valkenburg was aware of the deal struck in 2012.
He knew about the parameters of the agreement that we entered into with USDOJ.
County Attorney Van Valkenburg did.
Yes, he did.
Van Valkenburg is currently on vacation, and representatives from his office could not immediately be reached for comment. Allie Bovingdon says then-Attorney General, now Governor Steve Bullock, says the questions over jurisdiction between the federal government and the state are not his primary concern in this case.
His primary concern is making sure that victims of sexual assault are protected, cases are appropriately prosecuted, and offenders are held accountable.
The Department of Justice recently released a report harshly critical of how the Missoula County Attorney's Office has handled sexual assault in the past. Current Attorney General Tim Fox asked the DOJ to share any evidence of the county mishandling assault cases, as the 2012 agreement stipulates. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, newly named ambassador to China Max Baucus has unloaded almost $1.7 million from his campaign coffers since he announced he was leaving the U.S. Senate last year, including a recent major donation to a Democratic committee. Campaign finance reports show on January 31st, Baucus gave $475,000 to the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee as it seeks to retain the party's slim Senate majority in the November elections. The donation came as Baucus's nomination for ambassador was pending. The former chairman of the Senate Finance Committee had amassed $4.9 million in campaign money before unexpectedly announcing last April that he would not seek a seventh term. Campaign reports show he has since refunded at least $1.2 million. that includes $683,000 to dozens of political action committees and $520,000 to individual contributors.
The U.S. Supreme Court has denied a petition from Montana officials who wanted to revive the state's ban on political parties endorsing judicial candidates. Attorney General Tim Fox and Commissioner of Political Practices Jonathan Modell filed the petition to restore a prohibition on endorsements dating to 1935. In denying the petition, justices let stand a 2012 ruling from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which said the endorsements are allowed under the free speech rights of the First Amendment. Justices did not hear arguments in the case. Fox said today that he's concerned about federal courts invalidating state laws without giving states the chance to defend them. The 2012 ruling also allows spending by political parties on behalf of judicial candidates, but not direct contributions.
Friends of a 54-year-old Butte man who went missing during a morning run last week continue to search for him in the Delmo Lake area near Homestead Pass. The Butte Silver Bow County Sheriff's Office suspended its search for Jim Ryan on Friday night due to heavy snow, which continued through the weekend. Undersheriff George Skulicich says the search may resume later this week if the weather warms up. Ryan's wife reported him missing on February 19th when he did not return home from work. His locked car was found near the Delmo Lake trailhead. Officials say Ryan is an avid runner and likely stopped to go for a run on his way to work in Helena. Fellow runner Eddie Walker tells the Montana Standard friends continue to look for Ryan because, quote, he'd have our back.
A 28-year-old Bozeman man who left the police station while being questioned in a sexual assault case has waived extradition from Oregon, where he was arrested last week. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports Kevin Briggs waived extradition in Multnomah County Circuit Court in Portland, Oregon this morning. Gallatin County Attorney Marty Lambert said he's not sure when Briggs will be returned to Bozeman, where he faces charges of attempted sexual intercourse without consent, aggravated assault, assault on a peace officer, and escape. Officers say Briggs walked out of an unlocked interview room during a shift change early on February 1st. Briggs is required to register as a sex offender after being convicted of kidnapping and raping his 13-year-old former girlfriend in Helena in 2003 when he was 17.
A former Missoula man is jailed on $100,000 bail after being charged with raping a 13-year-old girl in August of 2012. The Missoulian reports 40-year-old Damon Parsons made an initial appearance in justice court yesterday on a charge of sexual intercourse without consent. Court records say a representative from the Montana Child Abuse Hotline called the Missoula County Sheriff's Office to report a 13-year-old girl alleged Parsons had raped her. Sheriff's Deputy Paige Pavilone says Parsons left Missoula in September 2012 before detectives could interview him. He was arrested in Portland, Oregon in December.
As construction on Cabela's 42,000-square-foot Missoula Outpost store continues, the company has announced job applications are now being accepted. The Missoula store will be Cabela's third in Montana, joining the 80,000-square-foot hunting, fishing, and outdoor gear store in Billings and another Outpost outlet in Kalispell. Cabela's spokesman Nathan Borowski says Outpost-style stores are designed for efficiency, flexibility, and convenience.
They'll offer a seasonal product assortment, and really what this does is allow us to build in markets where we haven't been able to access before and also closer into a populated areas. So it's kind of a newer format for us, and we're very excited about it and very excited for the Missoula store.
Borowski says Cabela's plans to hire approximately 90 full-time and part-time employees to staff the new Missoula store.
We want somebody able to come into the store and ask our employees what equipment they need and where they need to go to catch a trophy trout or something like that. So we definitely, you know, outdoor experience and a passionate outdoorsman and customer service oriented. You know, we try to provide Cabela's legendary customer service at all of our locations. And anybody that is interested in applying, all applications must be completed online. You can do that by visiting www.cabelas.jobs and then click on Apply Now and United States Jobs. And then you'll be asked to log in and follow the application process.
Borowski says wages will vary by position. Interviews will take place March 13th through the 15th at Holiday Inn Missoula downtown. The new Cabela's is located on Missoula's Brook Street, where the old Kmart used to be, and is scheduled to open sometime this summer. A specific date hasn't been determined.
A nonprofit company that services federal student loans plans to cut 10 to 15 jobs in Helena after losing a contract under the recent federal budget deal. Student Assistance Foundation spokeswoman Carolyn Bright tells the Independent Record SAF must also make some other cost and benefit reductions. Bright says early retirement options have been offered to about 30 employees. SAF and its for-profit subsidiary, True Student Inc., had been gearing up to service federal loans for several years. The federal government assumed direct control of federal student loans in 2010 instead of guaranteeing loans offered by other lenders such as SAF. While some nonprofits were allowed to service some loans, the December 2012 budget bill struck that provision. SAF services a $2.9 billion loan portfolio for 141,000 borrowers.
A construction worker escaped injury when the cargo trailer he was pulling with his pickup truck was struck by a train at a crossing in Butte. Skip Waldorf of Butte told the Montana Standard he was nearing the crossing just before 9 a.m. this morning when he saw the train coming around the bend. Because of the recent snowfall, he felt he would have been able to stop in time, so he decided to, quote, gun it across the tracks. He says the train was coming right at his window, and he was lucky to at least get his pickup across the tracks. The train struck his cargo trailer, tearing a hole in it.
More than two dozen cars of a BNSF Railway Company freight train hauling coal from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming to Minnesota have derailed in eastern Montana, spilling some of the load. BNSF spokesman Matt Jones says 29 cars toward the end of the 115-car train derailed just east of Terry at about 9 p.m. last night. The rail line remained blocked at midday today. Jones did not know how much coal was spilled, but said all 29 derailed cars tipped over and spilled some of their load. The cars hold an average of about 120 tons of coal each. The cause of the derailment is still under investigation.
The number of active hate groups across the Northwest dropped last year compared to 2012. That's according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, which today released its annual report on the number of hate groups operating in the United States. The number of hate groups in Washington dropped from 16 in 2012 to 10 last year. In Idaho, the number dropped from 17 to 9, and in Montana, the number dropped from 12 to 8. The number of hate groups in Oregon remained the same at 9. Nationally, the number of active hate groups dropped from 1,007 in 2012 to 939 last year.
As U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack is in charge of a lot more than the nation's food policy. His agency also oversees management of our national forests, and as a member of the cabinet, he advises the president on everything from the farm bill to the impacts of climate change. In this feature interview, Vilsack talks with News Director Sally Mock about those issues and more, starting with why he thinks the Affordable Care Act is a good deal for rural Americans.
Under the old healthcare system, rural folks paid more out-of-pocket expense than anybody else in America. They had less access to basic healthcare than anyone else in America. They had higher levels of uninsured than other places in the country, and the result was they had poor outcomes. So with the Affordable Care Act, we now have an opportunity for rural Americans to join with millions of other Americans to get expanded preventative care screenings, tests and screenings that will help them detect earlier illnesses and diseases. There are a lot of senior population in rural areas is quite high, and seniors are benefiting specifically from this preventative screening and test opportunity. There are young adults who are now covered under their parents' policy that weren't before. The drug costs are lower for seniors. The uninsured population is declining, and I think as folks learn more about this, they're going to find that they can get less affordable, or less costly, rather, insurance coverage through the Affordable Care Act.
The latest figures I have for Montana show about half of those who are eligible are now enrolled, and of course, time is running out. Is there any consideration of extending the deadline to get those people on?
Well, I don't think it's they're focused on extending the deadline. I think it's right now we're making sure that folks know that they have just a little bit over a month to get signed up. March 31 is the deadline. They can go on healthcare.gov and basically take a look at the options that they have, price out those options. And I think some folks might be surprised to find that they can get health insurance for as little as $100 a month.
I want to switch now away from healthcare and talk to you a little bit about the latest census figures on farming in this country. And as you know, Secretary Vilsack, we have an aging farm population. I think the latest statistics show that there are three times as many farmers over the age of 65 as under the age of 25. How worrisome is that?
Well, I think there are obviously some key concerns that were identified and addressed in the census. We actually are seeing an increase in farmers under the age of 35 years of age by virtue of the census. We've seen a slight increase over other census figures from previous census, and that's a good indicator. That's a good sign. We obviously have to continue that. I think the deepest concern that I have is what I'll refer to as sort of the eroding middle in agriculture, the middle-sized and medium-sized operations, the middle-aged farmers. We're seeing significant decreases in their numbers, which is a concern. The question is, who will be farming the land? Who will be providing this affordable and accessible food that we've grown accustomed to in the United States if we don't continue to attract more young people? So the key here, I think, from the census that I take, is the need to really focus on diversity and innovation, diversity in terms of crops that are raised, in market opportunities that can be created, in the people who will do the farming. We saw an increase in Hispanic farmers. We've seen an increase in American Indian and Asian farmers, Asian American farmers. So we obviously want to increase that opportunity, diversity in land use, and innovation in terms of research, how we might be able to continue to be more productive as we face some challenging weather circumstances and climate change. How are we going to be able to address that? So the census is an important document, and we have, I think, justifiable reasons to be concerned about the aging nature of the farming population. But I think there are strategies that have been incorporated in the recently passed Farm Bill that will help us begin the process of expanding opportunities for those new and beginning farmers.
You mentioned climate change, and of course one of the impacts of climate change is that the amount of agricultural land in production is shrinking. California is, of course, a prime example of that, the terrible drought there. And you've pointed out before that in 40 years, we're going to have to increase agriculture by 70% globally to feed the world. And we'll be doing that with less land available, correct?
Well, less potentially less land, and certainly more intense weather patterns and a unforgiving climate from time to time. One of the benefits from doing a census every 5 years is to track trends, and one trend that we are beginning to see diminish a bit is this conversion of agricultural land for other purposes. While we lost acreage from the last census, it was not quite as steep and not as many acres as we have lost in previous census. So I think that trend is slowing down, which is good. We want to be able to preserve as much farmland as we possibly can, and it gets back to this whole notion of innovation, being able to do the research, create new ways to produce products with less inputs, with less reliance on chemicals and pesticides, and with less water. And I think there are new seed technologies and new ways of irrigation that will allow us to do a better job and continue to be more productive. But it's not just America that's got that responsibility. It's also our global trading partners and agricultural partners in other parts of the world. They, too, have to pick up the pace.
And, of course, another impact of climate change and one of great concern to those of us who live in the West is the increasing number of wildfires. One recent statistic that came out is that wildfires will grow by 50 to 100% in the Western U.S. And I think over the last decade, we've already spent $3.5 billion to fight fires. President Obama has come out with a new proposal this week to pay for that firefighting out of a special disaster account. And that would be very helpful, would it not?
It would, and we clearly have seen a longer fire season. It's one of the reasons why we established climate change hubs to focus not only on agriculture but also on the impact of changing climates on the forests and how we might be able to determine better ways to mitigate and adapt to the changing climate. But to be able to do that, you have to have the resources to make your forests more resilient. You have to do more work to restore your forests, to thin them out to the proper way, to make sure you don't have hazardous fuel buildup that we've seen over the decades now, exacerbated by pine bark beetle and other infestations linked to warmer weather. to do that, we have to stop paying to fight fires from our general operating budget and our maintenance budget and begin treating forest fires as we do tornadoes, floods, and other natural disasters. And what the president has proposed and what Senator Wyden and Senator Crapo have proposed is a way to do that, in which we wouldn't be robbing the maintenance and restoration budget of the Forest Service. We'd be able to have greater predictability and certainty in that budget, which would allow us to do more work and hopefully over time reduce the risk of these more intense and very devastating fires.
And that appears to have bipartisan support at this point. It looks pretty hopeful.
It does, and I think it's a, you know, it's a very important point to make that when you look at American agriculture and American forest lands, they basically are a net carbon sink at this point in time. If you take all of our agriculture, all of our forested lands, it's about a 9% carbon sink, which is unusual for other aspects of the economy, obviously, are creating greenhouse gases. We want to maintain that positive aspect, but if our forests are going to burn up in devastating fires, we'll see those numbers reverse, and we'll be adding instead of subtracting from the greenhouse gases that we have to deal with. So it's in our long-term best interest. It's certainly in our economic best interest to figure out ways in which we can do a better job of restoring our forests and then figuring out additional market opportunities for that wood. It may not be high-valued wood that we're taking out of those forests, so we may be able to convert it into fuel, into energy, into new bio-based products that are being developed at the Forest Products Lab and in universities across the country. So it's an opportunity. It's a big challenge, but it's also an opportunity to diversify the Western economy.
Any doubt in your mind, Secretary Vilsack, that climate change is the environmental challenge of our time?
Well, I know there are a lot of environmental challenges, but I think it has the greatest potential impact on every aspect of our economy. If you're a coastal state or city, you obviously are concerned about rising sea levels. But if you're in the interior of the country, you're concerned about whether the fire season is going to continue to grow and become more intense. You're concerned about whether you're going to have adequate resources to be able to grow the crops that you've been growing in the past and be able to support your family as a result. If you're a livestock producer, you're wondering whether there'll be adequate forage. And if you're living in a city or town that is dependent on groundwater and surface water for drinking water, you're obviously going to be deeply concerned about the lack of water that currently is in many of the reservoirs and storage facilities throughout the West. So it is a big deal, and fortunately, we're beginning to take action. We've seen some progress in the last 4 or 5 years under this president, but there's a lot more to do, and I think what we're doing at USDA, pursuant to the president's climate action plan, is stepping up, and we're going to be doing the research and trying to focus on solutions for folks so that they can reduce greenhouse gases, they can mitigate the impact and hopefully adapt to things that can't be mitigated.
We have been speaking with Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk about these issues with us.
Happy to do it. Take care.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly clear with patchy freezing fog and lows 3 below to 10 below zero. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies and patchy freezing fog with highs in the upper 20s to mid-30s. For central Montana, tonight should be mostly clear with lows 10 below to 5 above zero. Tomorrow should be sunny with highs 30 to 35. For southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly clear skies, lows 5 below to 5 above zero, and tomorrow should be partly cloudy with highs in the 30s. And now for the editorial comments of Dan Gallagher.
This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint. Listen to these words. From these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. It was November 19, 1863, when the man from Springfield spoke to those gathered at Gettysburg. But my God, his words were timeless. It was not just Lincoln's eloquence that gives such importance to his remarks. It's his sensitivity and balance in addressing a major issue of his time and of all time, the meaning to be given to the supreme sacrifice in war. That topic is just as deep and sensitive and emotional and even visceral today as ever before. In my last commentary, I talked about whether soldiers ever die in vain, but I talked about it in more of a practical sense, trying to identify literal and factual grounds when this conclusion might be reached. Today, I speak about it from an emotional, even spiritual perspective, from the vantage point of one who witnessed war and a comrade's death. And while I had not supposed to be able to see through the eyes of a parent, spouse, or child of a loved one lost in battle, I want to try to look at it through the eyes and hearts of those who have experienced that sadness, with questions that they might well understand. So, is it possible for a soldier to ever accept or believe that the buddy who fell beside him gave his life in vain? Can a parent or spouse or child of a soldier who made the supreme sacrifice ever accept or even consider that their loved one died in vain and still retain their ability to hope or believe or maintain their own stability or spirituality? It's a fact as a human condition that while dwelling in a real practical world, we're constantly wanting to find meaning and redemption, not just the meaning of life, but some amount of redemption in death. Overwhelmingly, when you hear a parent speak of a child lost in war, or a child of a lost parent or a spouse who's lost her mate, you'll hear them lament the tragedy, maybe even vent anger at the politics that led to that war, but almost always you'll hear them view that soldier's service as noble and his death as having earned him a special place in a larger universe. But carrying that one step further, is it possible to find honor and nobility in a wartime death, no matter what the war was being fought about? Can the increased devotion to the cause that Lincoln referred to be true for the other side as well? When he spoke at Gettysburg, did Lincoln's words apply only to those who died for the Union, or did they also encompass the multitude of Johnny Rebs who had fallen on that field just 4 months earlier? And did the ladies decorating the Confederate graves at Friendship Cemetery in Vicksburg in 1864 see a greater spiritual truth when they returned the next day to put flowers on the graves of all Rebel and Yankee who had died in that battle? Did those who died wearing the Kaiser's uniform or the swastika or the communist hammer and sickle against American and Allied soldiers die in vain? Or was the nobility of their service greater than the politics that led them to war? If you could ask the mother or father or wife or son or daughter of one of those fallen, you'd likely get an answer similar to one you'd hear regarding America's fallen sons or daughters. And the question can be asked, by honoring wartime sacrifice, are we somehow sanitizing, maybe even justifying, war as an instrument for resolving our conflicts? In the process, by making the blood spilled in combat seem sacred, are we excusing or even encouraging those who seem bent on making war? Or are we simply exercising a necessity that we all have when we face the loss of a loved one, the necessity of saving our psyches by softening the tragedy and giving it a spiritual place in our hearts and thoughts? Well, after raising these questions, the fact is that I don't know the answers. In truth, while seeing all sides of this matter, I remain confused. I guess when I get right down to it, I come to the conclusion, and perhaps my Irish blood is showing through here, that there's a practical reality involved, but also a spiritual truth that, to me, trumps the practical. Based on the cause or the politics or the conduct of a war, we can practically see soldiers' deaths as being in vain, but in the personal, individual, emotional, and spiritual sense, we can separate the soldier's death from any aspect of the war's relative worth. Soldiers fight alongside one another and develop a bond stronger than anything political or material. They become the proverbial band of brothers. Often when they die, they do so with or for their soldier brothers. And they serve in the name of all with whom they share life in that place that they all call home. John's gospel tells us that greater love hath no man than this, that he should lay down his life for his brethren. And I guess that's how I still feel about it. This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint.
Dan Gallagher is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.